Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we'll be taking a deep dive into a EIS and SEIS fund manager. We're going to be looking at their portfolios and we're going to be looking at the sweet spots for investment. And to do that, we're very kindly joined by Fred Sonnenya, who is the co-founder of Hatch. Fred, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to being here and talking all about Hatch and what we're up to.
So I think looking at Hatch as a business and the funds that you have, we're going to be structuring this podcast, Fred. We're going to be looking at the broader picture to start with, and then we're going to go down into the more specific to some of the portfolio holdings later on in the podcast. But before we get going, please, would you be able to give us a brief introduction to Hatch, as well as the team and also yourself and the journey that you've been on to be the co-founder of Hatch, please?
Sure. So my name's Fred. I'm one of the two co-founders and four partners of Hatch. We originally founded Hatch back in 2013. So we've been around for a while now, but we actually founded Hatch as angel investors. So my co-founder, Scott, had founded a successful retail business, which exited to Morrisons, the supermarket. I was on that journey for a couple of years, both pre-acquisition and post-acquisition. And then on the back of that, we started angel investing. However, we always knew that we wanted to do something as a brand. So we kind of developed and created Hatch. Fast forward a few years, it was very apparent to us that there was people in the market that wanted to invest alongside us. And we were starting to turn down opportunities due to capacity. So we went on to launch, at the time, a relatively small EIS fund. Since then, we've expanded to having an SEIS fund as well, and also some institutional money. And of course, throughout the podcast, we can talk about those various funds and where they sit. The team is now 15 people, spanning partners, operating partners, our investment team, investor relations, and then portfolio support and operations. I think what's probably quite unique about the team is that everybody in the team is either a seasoned entrepreneur or operator. So everyone in the team has deep experience in lots of different domains and lots of different verticals, which really means the entire team can support underlying portfolio companies, which is really powerful when we speak to companies as a fund. So that's a little bit about Hatch, and I'm sure we'll dive into some specifics about what we look for and the types of companies we invest into shortly.
Indeed, we will, Fred. And I think that follows on very nicely to the next point here. And it is a question about, first of all, the stage of company that you like to invest in. We're going to be speaking a little bit later on in the podcast about the types of companies, the sectors that they're involved in. But I think to set the scene, it would be good to give listeners some context as to where you like to be involved in the company in its life cycle. So, you know, if you're able to discuss that the SEIS fund and the EIS fund and how that may differ across those two vehicles, that would be good to add some context, please.
Sure. So our SEIS fund is what we call our pre-seed fund. So our pre-seed fund invests in companies very early on. There's absolutely no minimum requirement in terms of revenue. But typically, companies have a founding team in place. They likely have an MVP, so minimal viable product in place. And they're starting to show some kind of value for a buyer. And ultimately, what we mean by that is whether you have a product or not, it's that you found a very deep pain in the industry and you found someone who's seeing some value in what you're building or what you're planning to build to solve for that pain. And that pre-seed fund, from an investor's perspective, obviously enables investors to invest in a wide range of SEIS companies. So typically we make between 10 and 15 SEIS investments per fund. So investors are getting a nice diversified portfolio of early stage investment opportunities, obviously with the significant tax benefits that SEIS tax relief brings, including that 50% income tax relief at the point of investment, and essentially 100% capital gains tax relief on any exits after 3 years, as well as the other kind of inheritance tax, capital gains deferral, and loss relief benefits as well. And what's really exciting about SEIS, I think, for the UK industry is that last year, the SEIS limits were increased. So now our standard pre-seed ticket to founders is actually £310,000, which is £250,000 of SEIS, plus £60,000 from our £10 million British Business Bank institutional fund. And for investors can invest up to £200,000 each per tax year. So our pre-seed SEIS fund is investing in companies at a very early stage that have identified a pain and are starting to show some kind of value for somebody in that market, ultimately somebody who's going to pay and drive revenue into that business. Our seed stage fund, which is our EIS fund, invests slightly later. So we make investments of kind of 300K to 800K on average in companies that at the very minimum are doing at least £10,000 a month of reoccurring revenue, so MRR. And what we look for at a seed stage is companies that are showing defined buying personas and sales motions, and they are showing evidence of being able to move through those sales motions. So what we mean by that is that we mean these are companies that have now identified their target market, they've identified their target buyer, they're building repeatable sales processes, they're showing that there's repeatable continued demand for their product or their solution, and they're starting to scale. And that seed stage EIS fund has mixed deal flow opportunities for it. So some are SEIS companies from our pre-seed SEIS fund, which are now kind of graduating. And then some are net new investments to Hatch. So that's outside of our SEIS fund. For investors, it provides investors with kind of 4 to 6 seed stage companies on average. We do 3 closes throughout the year. So investors can build a portfolio of 12 to 15 companies throughout the year. And again, slightly later stage than SEIS. So a slightly different risk appetite profile there. Interestingly, both targeting the same type of return. So we wouldn't necessarily deem one to be riskier than the other. We'd say that we help offset the earlier risks of the SEIS fund with a larger diversified portfolio, whereas the EIS fund kind of more doubles down in certain portfolio companies. So we really are pre-seed and seed investors. We have no appetite to invest at Series A and beyond. Our goal is very simple, which is to support portfolio companies get to that magic £1 million of annualized recurring revenue, and to build the infrastructure to get to £10 million plus. And the reason that £1 million is really important is because that is the Series A benchmark in the UK. So our goal is to get companies from pre-revenue to £1 million, help them raise a Series A from an institutional VC, and then support them in the background whilst they scale to £10 million plus.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Fred. And we're going to be discussing some examples of those portfolio companies a little bit later on in the podcast. But we've set the scene very nicely there in terms of the stage that Hatch invests. But I think the next point that we should elaborate on, if we may, Fred, is the particular sectors and the particular type of company that you're investing in. Of course, it's technology, but I believe, Fred, it's almost exclusively software as a service, SaaS businesses. The question is, what in particular about these types of companies has made them so attractive that you've built a whole fund around these forms of companies?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we started life kind of investing in what we describe as retail or e-commerce technology businesses. And actually what we realized is the same challenges that apply to an e-commerce business also apply to every other vertical, and realize actually what we really like are B2B SaaS companies. So although we've invested in consumer in the past, we found the problem with consumer is it's very capital intensive And it's quite a binary outcome adventure. You either have a huge success in consumer, or you kind of miss the mark and it doesn't fit. And also the benchmarks for what good looks like change a lot in consumer. With B2B SaaS, what we really like is that investing in B2B SaaS is very metric driven. So there's very clear goals that a company needs to achieve, whether that be £1 million in annualized recurring revenue to raise their Series A round, whether it be showing that they have positive net revenue retention, so they're expanding contracts, whether that be that their churn rate is low, sub 3%, so that people are not churning, contracts are renewing. So we really like being metric-driven investors, and it keeps everybody focused on what success looks like. I also think that B2B provides really interesting, value. Ultimately, instead of investing in the kind of companies that are household names, we kind of define it internally, I guess, that we like to invest in the companies that power those internal names. And I'm sure we can talk about some examples later. We're solely focused on B2B SaaS now, reoccurring revenue. We really like revenue that comes in every month, month in, month out.
Fantastic. Thank you. So staying on the subject of the SaaS businesses, the B2B side of things, from where you're sitting, Fred, when you're looking, maybe at the stage that you're making the initial investments and then fast forward into the future for potential exits, what do the valuations look like for SaaS businesses, B2B SaaS businesses, compared to other types of technology companies that may also have a subscription model? Obviously, those reoccurring revenues, but they don't really fit the bill as being a SaaS company. Is there any major valuation differences that you see being achieved between those two?
I think valuation is a great point, actually. And I think, for us, we see acquisitions in market, have kind of exponential valuations when they're SaaS companies, when they're reoccurring revenue. And if you look at some of the biggest public companies, they are subscription-based companies, and they all have SaaS offerings or buy SaaS businesses. We've definitely become vertical agnostic, so actually we do have investments in health tech, we do have investments in fit tech and e-commerce and so on and so on. However, the unique part across all of those is that, and the bit that kind of aligns all of our founders, is that they're all business to business. So the end person paying is a business, not a consumer. And they all have recurring revenue. So from a valuation perspective, I think B2B SaaS companies are typically valued at 10x or more their ARR versus a services company that might be valued at 1 to 2x their actual EBITDA. So it's significantly different.
I want to go back to a couple of points that you made earlier on in the podcast, Fred, and that was mentioning the word pain. And it's looking at the companies that you invest in, and you did allude to it there, that there is a broad selection of companies operating in different sectors, but they do all have the subscription model. So I want to talk about the pain that you mentioned earlier and identifying that pain. And maybe you could give some examples of real world situations where you're looking at a company, they've identified a particular pain and then built a SaaS model around it. I think that'd be very interesting for listeners if you could elaborate on that and what you mean by a pain and how that feeds through into your investment process.
Sure. So the reason that we talk about looking for a pain is that quite often you can be distracted, we found, with these kind of future opportunities. So, we're building a business to do X, Y, and Z, something crazy, make pizzas on Mars, as an example. And I get it 100% all for that aspiration. However, what we find actually is that businesses that survive are businesses that generate revenue and go on to be acquired. And ultimately, no one's going to pay for a product unless there's a reason to pay for it. So we start right at the beginning of a pain. And that pain can be something really simple. So if I take Harbour, which is an example of a pre-seed portfolio company of ours in the fintech vertical, their pain is very simple. There's very high costs and friction between moving money between traditional finance and crypto. So they've identified a pain. Or take someone like Money Savvy in our SEIS portfolio. So a very early stage company, pre-launch, but their pain and the solution they're building is that there's more than 15 million people in the UK that can no longer get access to a financial advisor. And we have many, many examples of these. And it can be someone like PubX, who's a more development, more developed company in our portfolio, which, you know, their pain is around the lack of technology available to digital publishers to enable them to effectively create revenue. So whenever we talk about a company or whenever we talk to a company, the first thing we start with is the pain. Thereafter, we talk about who experiences that pain in that organization. So this is the B2B element, and who has the budget and who is willing to pay to solve that pain. Once we've identified that, we then start talking about the solution. And actually the solution is obviously is quite often the easiest bit. And what I mean by that is that technology is becoming democratized, becoming easier to build technology companies. It's still very hard to get someone to pay. So take a company called Fingtrax in our portfolio, raised £4 million seed round last year. They identified a pain in manufacturing. We spent a lot of time understanding who in manufacturing was experiencing that pain, and importantly, who in manufacturing had the budget and was the decision maker. Once we understood that, we then learned about their technology platform, we learned about what they were building and how that solved the pain. And ultimately, they've ended up being a really successful company that raised a fantastic seed round and is multi-million revenue business now. So I think it's really important to take it back to basics. So lots of examples across the portfolio, but founders are often quite surprised. Like the first time we have a conversation with them, it's, can we talk about the pain, not the solution for a moment? Because quite often people build stuff and there's not someone willing to pay for it.
Yes, that's a very good point. Thank you very much for providing some detail there, Fred. I mean, that seems to be the genesis of the investment approach for Hatch. I think that's very important, very insightful. And you did mention a number of portfolio companies there, but I would like to speak now, if we may, in a bit more detail about some of the portfolio companies. Maybe if we start with some recent investments that you've made that excite you the most. I'm sure they all excite you because you've made investments in them. But if you have any standout ones that you'd like to discuss in more detail, I'm sure listeners would be interested to hear their stories, maybe bringing the pain and why you invested and where you see the company going.
Sure. So, you know, like you say, it's very hard to pick favorites. We have a portfolio of 80 companies at the moment. But a couple of recent investments that spring to mind. One is a business called Shaka. So this is actually a company that I led through our investment process last year. And the pain that Shaka is solving is around brands being able to monetize their customers. And what Shaka do is they enable brands to launch virtual mobile networks. So this is a pain that we experienced in our old life, actually, when we sold a business into Morrisons. We tried to launch the Morrisons mobile network as a loyalty tool and as an added benefit to our customers. How actually the infrastructure didn't exist, was very bespoke and very difficult build. So Shaka enable primarily fintechs, but also influencers to launch their own mobile networks. Why that's quite exciting is with the adoption of eSIM technology, the barrier to actually move from a traditional mobile network like an EE or an O2 to a mobile network, imagine a Mr. Beast mobile network, or a Kylie Minogue mobile network, or an American Express mobile network, was actually, there is no barrier anymore, because with eSIM, you just download an app, install an eSIM, and your number's ported across, and it becomes part of your subscription. So really excited about them. And again, it's a great example of, we've had opportunities to invest in challenger mobile networks over the years. We haven't, because we've always thought the market size is capped, and we haven't wanted to invest in that consumer business. So instead, it's a great example of investing in the technology behind the scenes that powers that. Another great example of a recent investment, which was a university spin out that we invested in last year from a great team PhDs there. It's a business called ROEX. And ROEX is focused on professional music industry, and it enables the mixing and mastering of music to happen using their AI tool. And I think what's really interesting here is that AI is a bit of a buzzword at the moment. Lots of people just throw the AI word out there and talk about it. What ROEX have done is they're actually using AI and what we call really applied AI to really solve a deep pain. So they've identified a process in the music industry before records get published, before songs get published online, and they've gone and solved that and removed the manual labor and cost from that with AI, which I think is really smart. So lots of companies covering lots of different verticals. The vertical I'm most excited about is vertical SaaS companies. So these are companies that are going really deep with inside a vertical. So they're kind of building the operating systems for those verticals. We have a business called AeroCloud, which powers end-to-end how airports operate. And we have a business called Ningi, which powers end-to-end how financial advisors operate. Exactly the same premise, exactly the same type of business in that vertical SaaS, but completely different industries. And we have about 18 of those at the moment. So that's been a real focus on the investments I've made over the last couple of years.
You made a point there about AI, Fred. I'd just like to speak about that, if we may, very quickly. You know, in terms of the potential deal flow that you're seeing coming through, are there and has there been a growth in the number of companies that are saying that they're using AI and having that as a main feature as their investment case, or ones that are in the deep tech side of AI, maybe looking at language models that you're seeing here in the UK? What does that industry look like at the moment?
Yeah, I think over the last few years, I've seen kind of three shifts in every pitch we've received. Originally, it was blockchain, and then it was Web3, and now it's AI. So you have to filter that out and actually focus on fundamentally what the company is and what it's doing. I think for us, we don't have a deep AI thesis at the moment. I don't think many funds do. Instead, what we're very focused on is how AI can accelerate our portfolio companies and the types of investments we're making. And that can be at the underlying infrastructure level. However, typically very expensive, very big rounds to go out and build large language models, or it can be at the kind of application or delivery level. I still don't think we've seen the killer AI application yet that's going to take AI mass market. But what I think we have seen is AI start to replace roles and start to replace technology and start to accelerate the adoption of technology. And that's very much what we're focused on when we make investments.
Fantastic. Thank you, Fred. So I understand that as a fund, there's been a number of notable exits. And that's something that I'd like to move on to discuss now. And it would be good, I think, for listeners to get an idea of the companies that you've invested in, their journey to exit, and some of the characteristics that you found between the companies that they shared that actually resulted in that success of them being taken over and providing investors with an exit and a return?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, I think it comes back to the first point is survival. So the majority of businesses I see go bust because they've run out of money, and they've run out of money is the output of either a bad decision or hiring at the wrong time, spending too much here at the wrong time, or not solving a pain that's deep enough. But I think that the first thing is survival, and that can take lots of different forms. And one of the biggest forms that can take is around pivoting and being open to change. And the most successful entrepreneurs and the people that I see come out the other side and the people that exit businesses are the people that never gave up. And they're the people that, you know, with their back against the wall, at 1 minute to midnight, when everything's going to come falling down, they still found a way through. And I think that's the number one challenge in the venture market. I get it. Venture is all about home run success, outlier returns, and ultimately people raise money. They try and prove a pain. They try and prove a solution. And if it doesn't work, they don't find product market fit, then more often or not, they're wind down. And I understand why, and I understand that's part of the venture business. we're in that business ultimately. However, the people that do come out the other side, the people that do exit, are the people that have the grit and the people that don't give up. And actually they go, look, this business isn't right, or this problem we're solving isn't deep enough, or the solution we've built isn't right, or we've hired too many people, and they cut back to the bones and they continue to push on. I don't think there's ever the perfect success story of, you know, the perfect pre-seed round, the perfect Series A round, and the perfect exit. I think there's always a roller coaster journey along the way. So for me, it's very much around being adaptable, being able to flex, being able to pivot, being able to change. That's really, really important to me. And that's where I see exits, and that's when I see founders be successful. And of course, along the way, there's some serendipity or some luck or some alignment. And some of that is just around surrounding yourself with the right people. Some of that is around being aware. But also, you know, I've been involved in an exit where, you know, out of nowhere, a company approached this company. We had never heard of this company before. We had never never come across them in any of our kind of exit market mapping. And it just so happened they were a $1.5 billion NYSE listed market cap company. So there's lots of, you know, people out there that you can't plan for. But I think surviving is the number one name in the game. Continuing focus and having flexibility is really important. So they're the kinds of, I guess, three or four successful traits that I see when people come out the other side.
So you did touch in some way on my next point, which is, you know, the exits that you've achieved through the portfolio and that process of seeing how the companies achieved those exits. How's that, Fred, influenced your approach to making new investments and the companies that you seek out? You know, going through the process of the exit over the years, seeing that, you know, how's that influenced what you do going forward from that point in terms of building the portfolio?
So I think I think a couple of things. I think firstly, it reminds us every time that this journey is a long one. In fact, I read a stat last year which the average founder investor relationship is longer than the average marriage worldwide, which is obviously quite a sad stat, but is also a good reminder that actually, you know, you have to be able to work with people, and you have to be able to work with people when things go wrong. I think the second thing is that actually venture capital is not for every founder, and that's fine. I think founders should be really aware of what they're doing when they raise money. And whether you raise £20,000 from friends or you raise £20 million from venture capital, and usually it's, you know, a mix of both, the reality is that as soon as you take external money in, you're now on a venture journey where investors expect a return, and ultimately those investors expect a return by you exiting. And therefore, a big part of our kind of thesis or learnings from exits that we take into every investment decision are, is this team aware of that? Do they understand it's going to be a long journey? Are they the right type of venture backable company? And can we all work together?
Thank you. So this is the last point on the portfolio companies that you select, Fred. And it's, you know, it's a question which goes beyond the most obvious. We've, of course, discussed, you know, having a great team, identifying a pain in the industry for the companies that you look at. But apart from those very obvious things, what are the main features that you look for in a company when selecting them for your portfolio?
So we've spoken about, obviously, team, and we've spoken about pain a lot. And I think not many investors will talk about pain. So that's definitely a unique one on our side in terms of how we describe it. I think, you know, for us, outside of those, we look at the unit economics of the business. So revenue is a sexy word again in venture capital, which is great. I think that's good for the industry. So we're very focused on how quickly we think this company can start generating revenue and how quickly we think this company can become break even if they want to. Again, to the last discussion we had around exits, survival is key. So, you know, across team, across market size and opportunity, and all the usual stuff that VCs will talk about. I think, you know, back to, you know, my point on pain, that's the number one thing we're focused on. Is this pain deep enough? Are there buyers that are feeling this? Do they have the budget, and are they going to pay for it? And that strategy seems to be working well.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Fred. And just a note to listeners, if you check out the notes to this podcast, there'll be a link through to the Hatch website where you'll be able to explore their funds in more detail. But just as a final point, Fred, you know, for people that are looking at Hatch, looking at the EIS and the SEIS funds, you know, are there any deadlines coming up? I believe it's a fund that's somewhat evergreen. Are there soft closes that you have? Are there anything that investors should be aware of in the near future?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the run-up to the end of the tax year, we'll be closing our EIS fund, which will be fully deploying in this tax year still. So we need money and applications by the end of March at the latest. And our SEIS fund will close sometime in April for deployment in the next tax year. Of course, we're always open on both, but this is the last opportunity this tax year to invest in EIS. The SEIS window is already closed. So please do reach out to me if you'd like to talk more. Very happy to have a conversation.
Thank you. And just another note, if you do want to get in touch with Fred directly, there will be a link through to the website. We'll be able to do that. So Fred, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a great conversation, and hopefully the listeners enjoyed.
Yes, very much so. And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.